Over these many days, we've been here together in silence mostly, and we have been extremely creative, more so than it might seem, because we haven't really been consuming like we usually are doing much of the time, consuming all the things that we're consuming, taking in, waiting, expecting. We've been actually producers of our experience to whatever degree we have been. Sometimes it hasn't been easy. Sometimes what's come forth is not really pleasant, not really easy. Sometimes there's been a great opening, a lot of letting go, a lot of shedding, a lot of new stuff. But it's been created by just being here and sitting. I think that's kind of amazing because we live in the world very engaged in many things, and many of the things that we're engaged with are actually not getting us to be creating much from inside of ourselves. Where much of the time, moving along, reacting, doing our habitual acts, and getting by in the world. But here we've been stopping, and in a very simple, basic way, with some very simple tools, very basic tools. We haven't really given them that much to you. We've only offered four or so, maybe five different practices. Breathing, mental and bodily sensations, mindfulness of those, mindfulness of emotions, mindfulness of thoughts, and then centering with samadhi and experiencing the arising and the passing. That's it. It's not very much more. But those have been great tools to let things bubble up, see things we might not have seen, find new ways of seeing ourselves that we hadn't seen, discover things about ourselves and see them more clearly, many times resolve things about ourselves, sometimes problematize things. And what I'm interested in underscoring is that we have been in a position of putting something together, putting something of our own that speaks to something very unique inside of us. We've been giving ourselves the opportunity to be creative, maybe in a way that we haven't really been so much, being creative about our own content. A new content, maybe even at times. But that's really something pretty rare. And it's kind of wonderful because it's totally new. It has never existed in this world. And it can emerge and re-exist again and again and again, if we are the creators of our experience, if we pause, we stop, we listen, take in, give permission, allow, soften up, know it, see it, sense it, feel it. And one of the things we've created, if we can point to anything, is we've created a wise being. In the ancient times, there was a term for this, actually, for the most awakened person in our tradition before they came up with the term arhat, I believe. The term was a sage at peace. sage at peace. Isn't that nice? To be a sage at peace. There's a collection of poems that includes this way of looking at enlightenment way before, allegedly, according to the what we know so far, scholastically and academically, before there was the Arhat, before there was the awakened one, before there was a Bodhisattva or a Buddha, there was a sage at peace. That was the highest goal, to be someone who knew how to be at peace. And so how is a sage at peace? Here's a stanza. Whatever was before, let it wither away. After, let there not be anything for yourself. If in the present you will not grab hold, you will live your life at peace. Another stanza. Leaving behind both the inclination to sensuality and unhappiness of mind, and dismissing laziness and warding off regrets. Him I call at peace, one not hoping for the objects of desire. With him there are no ties to be found. He has crossed over attachment. And so this mind of not attachment, this mind of letting go, this mind of releasing that comes forth with these four big components of, like, think of them as like four parts of an orchestra. The breath, the body, sensations, and emotions. Because we can do so much of them and create so much music, so to speak. So much of our, so many different experiences. Each one of you has, whom I've met a lot of you, most of you, I think, all of you probably by now, have shared worlds of experiences, transformative, difficult, really, really difficult at times, painful, opening, resulting in, sometimes in the bright cases, in a, someone called it a narrative of beauty. And the beauty that's showing up, that comes from no attachment, is this beauty of mind. A beauty of a mind that's not attached. A beauty of a mind that's not attached is a mind that's clear. A mind that has let go enough to have this clarity. And that comes from a letting go of what is suffering, of releasing, allowing the suffering to get released. That's what is maybe one of the most beautiful things, according to our tradition, a mind that is so calm, so settled, so relaxed, that it can see the suffering that arises, the suffering that's there, the suffering that goes, and then knows that suffering goes because arising and passing, flowing, are going and going and going. And we tune into this. We've tuned into this over and over again. We know that yesterday was not like today, and there's been this constant flowing, unveiling new things for us to become wiser about how we do our lives, how we move about our lives, how we create our lives, how we repeat things and how we habituate in the same way, and how we can also change that, because we're seeing that it's not the only way, that there are other ways. And so it's very encouraging to find this peace and touch into this depth that we've been touching. And it's a path of courage to do this. The Buddha gives us these analogies, these similes actually, for a mind that's been freed up of hindrances. And we've been saying them throughout a bit, mostly. But a mind that's free of sensual desire is a mind that's likened to being free of debt. What would be free of debt feel like? It means you're solvent, you're wealthy, you have all that you need. So there's no need for more, which is the problem when sensual desire becomes an attachment. Sensual desire is not a problem, it's when there is that attachment that that kind of limits us and entraps us and feels very afflictive. And so to feel wealthy instead, that's the experience. And then the abeyance of ill will produces a mind that is full of well-being. This one always spoke to me a lot, because I had a lot of ill will at a certain, maybe a decade of my practice, it seemed. And but it was a will of trying to stop the pain. I had a lot of aversion to pain, and it took a while to figure out that I had aversion to pain. And it was a form of ill will because I was really attached for this pain to stop. But I didn't realize that I was becoming sick. Because when we are attacked by the hindrance of ill will, it's like we're making ourselves sick. So that really helped me a lot when I finally got that. So to be full of well-being when the abeyance of ill will ceases. So health emerges when ill will is gone. And when sloth and torpor is calmed, maybe even unhindered completely, what comes is this freedom to act that we didn't have before. So I think that's nice. Restlessness and remorse is another freedom to act, because we're released, like from being in jail. So we have hands, we have ability to act. And then doubt, when that finally goes away, it's like having security. Security, and because it's the end of you made a journey that was really long, finally, and you were traveling in that journey with a lot of goods, and you made it to the other side, and you were safe. So it's being safe, making it through a long journey. So all these beautiful things have been created here, generically, in one way or another, when you've moved through your hindrance, if you've had a hindrance, or two, or more. If you have, then this has been something you have created in your experience. Maybe you haven't called it that, but some semblance of something like this has come up for you. That's really important to know that that you have had that agency, that your simple basic practice has, you've had that agency in your practice. Because that's not how life goes. necessarily. We're driven to by things. We're obsessed by things. We're approached by so many stimuli from the world that, and we are used to being consumers. Maybe, I don't know, previous generations, but I mostly see people on this little device crossing the street. Instead of looking into my eyes when they're crossing the street, they're looking at their device, and everywhere it seems that this device is rampant. If it's not here, then it's on the wrist. If it's not on the wrist, then it's in the ears. And so we're receiving, we're constantly consuming, 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 consuming. And there's a time and there's a place for that. But here we have not been consuming the infotainment, the infomedia, the varieties of ways that we get our information, our entertainment, our knowledge. So this is very unique to be no, recognize that you're creating, that there's a creative process that's very potent in the simple act of seemingly doing nothing. That's the great paradox. It seems like we're not doing anything here, but we're doing a lot. And I want to underscore this because it keeps opening things up. It has done that this whole week. It's been fantastic to witness that. How much has come forth from this practice here, from all of you, from all of your practice. It's a little bit like seeing masterworks of art emerge to me. Because I love art. I studied the literary arts in college, comparative literature and critical theory, and so I had to really get into the analysis of art at that time. This was when I was in college, right? And so I adore art, and you get into critical theory, and then you kind of forget what art is, because it's you just get into becoming critic and postcolonial and postmodern, and I forgot what art was for a while in college, and then I realized I remember I finally saw what it was. It was reading one of the great philosophers of art, who I think is the clearest on it. And what I learned to see is that a work of art is what makes a work of art, like, what is it that makes a work of art great? What is it? It's not very complex and it's not very theoretical. It can be absolutely theoretical. But it's that the work of art that's hanging in a museum or has museum-like quality, there's something to that, to it. And the best way that I've learned to appreciate it is that it's its own thing. It's not, we can project and discuss millions of things about it. And that makes us, that's very enjoyable. But a real work of art is something different for each one of us, probably. And it's this thing that has a living, almost a living quality that it is actually creating itself in the moment, again and again and again. If you keep looking at great works of art, they have this incredible quality. Literary arts do that. Great books do that, right? Great poetry does that as well. So does music. It has this essence of like this constant emergence of something new, something unique that is its own thing. And that's what it's been like to me at times, many times, maybe most of the times, maybe every time, I don't know, to be with you. I haven't been thinking about this. I thought about this now. When I've been with you, we've been with you, your life, I assure you. I hope you feel that. That's how it was. It was how it was for me. But in retrospect, there's this uniqueness. There's this amazing richness and fullness that's emerging right before my eyes, and before your eyes, and before your lives. And you're building something. It's a beautiful thing. You're constructing your life anew, again and again and again, and hopefully ongoingly. And boy, is that an inspiring thing in this universe of consumerism, of repetitiveness. It's a beautiful thing because what makes it a work of art is that there's only one of you. And so as you shed and grow through and branch out and dig out and accept and see and know what there is to know and feel. So hard to feel some things, terribly hard to feel something, but you have the courage to go through all that. Your essence emerges more and more. And then you're not all those reactions and all of those beginningless times, inheritances that we got from society and we got from family and that we have to participate in because we live in a world. So that's pretty grand to me. And the hindrances are really important things to keep an eye on because they block this flow of life. They hinder this living essence of being. They are the five things that are worth remembering. If there's anything worth remembering in this, the teachings and all of the teachings and the endless lists is how the hindrances go into abeyance. Those five things that I described, that there is a wealth instead of being trapped by sensual desire, that there is health instead of aversion. And that there's freedom from bondage. There's ability to use yourself differently. And that there's security. That's really worthwhile to remember, if nothing else, so that when the hindrances are there, there's some impetus to recognize them, like we've been saying, to recognize them, identify them. That does so much already, because it admits them. It like admits them into view, admits them into you. And so then there's a whole opportunity for your creative awareness to do something with them and begin the process that begins once they're identified. That's just maybe the most important thing, at least to know them. This is ill will. This is sloth and torpor. Okay, this is really restlessness. This is doubt. This is sensual desire. Maybe before taking the train towards sensual desire, which is so easy to fall on. And there's a beautiful thing about these hindrances in one of the suttas related a little bit to what I'm talking about what is freed up in the mind for us to have access to. And I'm going to read the conclusion, basically, of a large little dialogue that the Buddha is having with this Brahmin who wants to know, why is it that I can't remember the hymns that I have recited over and over and over again? Why is it that I can't remember the hymns that I haven't remembered in a long time? And he's wondering what's happening with my memory. Memory was a really important thing in ancient India because that's how knowledge was passed. And so you wanted to really be sharp to be able to have the teachings because those were the people who were able to teach and share. And so the conclusion goes something like this. and I'm squeezing them all together, all the five hindrances. When one dwells with a mind that is not obsessed by sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and regret or doubt, on that occasion, one knows as it really is one's own good and the good of others and the good of both. And this is the good part coming up. Then, even those hymns that have not been recited over a long period of time recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited. I'm going to say that again, please, if you allow me, because I like that a lot. Then, even those hymns that have not been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited. So your memory, your sharpness, your clarity, your ability to have cognition and have all of your faculties working work better when the hindrances are not there, and we have access to things in our mind that we don't even know about because we can't actually think our way into those levels of the mind. It's the mind's creativity that's being pointed to here. The mind that just is just so productive and offers so much if it's allowed to function. And the hindrances do not allow it to function. And what also proceeds that connects a little bit to building peace is that as we know more, as we are able to move through the hindrances, we come to more continually to this visceral knowledge. We come to this, we get to, we see these things about our, about what's going on for us, what's in our lives, and we get this visceral knowledge of them that's an evidence that nobody can take away from you. And but it's also an evidence that is a knowledge that has a lot of security because you know it because you've felt it from the inside. You know it because you've lived through it. You've seen what everything about it that you needed to see. And now you know, well, it's better if I don't take that route because that's an entrapment toward whatever the entrapment is. To have that visibility to choose and to know that's not the way to go about relating to this person. It's not the way to go about relating to my heart. That's not the way to go about not seeing what I really might want. And there's this word that's not really a Buddhist word that I like related to this, and it's a word called, it's a word gnosis, which is a form of knowledge that is inclusive of everything. And that's how this knowledge is a knowledge that includes our entire being, includes our bones, includes our breath, includes the layers of mind, body, mysteries. There includes our senses. It's an all-inclusive gnosis. And a very little side note, this gnosis is got a connection somehow etymologically to the word jhana in Sanskrit, which is really beautiful because jhanas are not just a state of absorptions. They're connected to this deep sense of really fully belonging in completely and totally, which captures a little bit of what concentration happens in concentration. And so to create, we've been creating, you've been creating. In meditation, I created lots of things too. One of the things that I had to that I created over time was a different body. We all have a different body, and it's not always a smooth process of creation. Sometimes the body actually is hurting more. Sometimes it's hurting less. And it's part of a process of a lot of changes going on in the body, through the practice. But when I came to practice, my body was very, very unwell. I meditated laying down in that bench for almost, I don't know how many years. Old people who've been here a long time know how many years I was there, because I had failback syndrome, and I didn't walk for 3 years, and it was I was left to the residue of severe neuropathic pain, and so I couldn't even get close to sitting. And over time, I started to understand what it was like to create a new body. What it's like to be sensing and be in sensation versus being in pain, versus the concept of pain, the ideas of pain, and what's really being in sense, and the level of sensation all the way through can be like. I can tell you, deeply transforming over time, because the mind, we've been inhabiting our body. Every time we are sensing, it's like the mind is going into the body. It's not really like that, but that's the kind of the metaphor. We are entering the body, and we're knowing the body now, because it's like filling up the body with the light of knowing, if you allow. But like the light of awareness is turning on inside the body. That's why maybe some people use this expression, lighten up the body. Lighten up the body in meditation is the awareness of the sensing living body. And it's a different body than when I'm not mindful. That one. So to continue with what we've been being creative here, we've been also talking about the five faculties. And I'd like to share that some maybe interesting, maybe ways that you might be creative with these five faculties going forward, because it's really good to engage these five faculties repeatedly. It's good to be aware of them, to recognize when they're there, know them, learn to understand what they're about, what their unique contribution is to the experience that you're having or that you want to have, because then they evolve, and as they evolve, the tradition calls them the five powers that guard us. And the one that we mostly recognize as that, as a companion, is mindfulness. Well, this is a mindfulness practice, and we talk a lot about mindfulness as a companion to us. So five ways that maybe you want to consider relating to these five faculties is trust and joy. Let me remember this. Okay, to trust your faith, to enjoy your energy, to love your mindfulness, to revere your samadhi, and to heed your wisdom. When we trust our faith, we return to, for us here, that where we've now been practicing our faith, we've shown up here, we return to our own goodness, knowing our own something good is there. Well, there's the path to liberation that's there. And when we trust our faith, we are able to return to the practice. And this is a really wholesome cycle, because the more we remember to have faith and to trust and believe in the practice, the more the practice shows up for us. However the practice shows up for you. Hopefully you go sit and meditate, but hopefully the practice just shows up for you, however the practice shows up for you. I don't want to be a stickler on sitting meditation. The practice evolves, and there's many forms of practicing, there are many postures, and they were recommended for a good reason, I think. Sitting posture is great. Sitting posture does lead to the attainment of the fruits of the practice. But faith, to just return to however the practice shows up. And then it builds. And the builds, it keeps building and as becomes more and more secure, becomes even unshakable, because we have more and more data that, oh, this works. Something here works. And we forget. But faith is important to remind us to keep coming back to the wholesomeness that we know is available through the practice. And when faith meets desire, that's a very interesting connection, right? As Gil discussed on Monday, because then desire has a way, a very wonderful direction to go. Then we really connect and tap into that desire for the good. And when there's that desire for the practice, that desire for our own liberation, that desire for our own reduction of suffering, that's really cool. Because the more of that there is, guess what? The less of the sensual desire there will be. There will still be sensual desire, but at least we have a support, something to back us up when the thrills and the obsessions and the pulls that lead to the attachment of sensual desire take us over, or maybe before they take us over. And we have this ally in believing, no, I know, and I know that this is the better way. And it's about the big decision, the big things and the small things. For me recently, I gave up a certain kind of sugar that I used to love, and it's been really helpful to get realigned with what I believe. I believe in feeling a certain kind of health that I was losing by consuming too much of the sugar. I love cherry preserves. I don't love them. I adore them. But I had to do a dramatic cut down. And so it was quite difficult, because it was a pattern. I liked them at this time, I liked them then, and I liked them then. And I had to have them then and then and then. And I know this is not very serious and not very important, but it's about sensual desire. So this is a small sensual desire, right? This is not the big problems of sensual desire. But it really helped to get realigned and remember that, understand my sensual desire, not push myself. It was a real. I was careful with myself. I didn't just try to stop cold turkey, because I knew that I've tried that. That doesn't work. And so I just reduced it, reduced it, reduced it. And then I weighed myself. That really helped the reduction, because it was a real problem to me at that, not that long ago. So But it felt so good to go into the kitchen in my usual time and see that pull to go to that jar of cherry preserves and not do it, and then do it and have all of this mindfulness be there for me, and instead choose what I had chosen would be the replacement, which was five almonds. Have my five almonds religiously because I'm still working on it, but I'm making light of something that's very serious, that it was really a trust. It was having this deep layer of trust in just being aware. I realized that my awareness would get lost, and I would only wake up to my awareness when I was in bed, thinking, why did I have those 4 tablespoons of cherry preserve? It was wonderful to go to bed and not have that. But it was that aliveness of awareness that I was really present to, because it was very clear to me that it was very related to my practice of the serious sensual pleasures. It was very similar to the big decisions that could lead to very unproductive sensual desire, like media, the consumption of media, the consumption of the machine. I'm going to go a little off tangent. I'll get back to the faculties, I promise. Oh no, I don't can't go off topic. I'm almost off time. So sensual desire will serve as my example of the importance to have a keep being creative with these five faculties, because the more that they keep or stay around, the more that they'll actually be there for you. My example there was a rather silly example. I apologize if it was too silly for you, but it's really about these faculties are there if we nourish them. And we can nourish them if we trust them, if we trust faith, if we enjoy our energy when our energy is available, when our energy is not too effortful, and when we can see, wow, that little bit of effort to push to go to that sit really was great. That's a great enjoyment. Right there, your energy builds as a faculty for you. And to love mindfulness, to love the creative contemplation that opens up, how things dissolve thanks to its majestic way of seeing that it makes available to us. To love that, to love that. And then to revere samadhi when samadhi is available to you, when samadhi gives you the grace, when there's been enough continuity of mindfulness that you've released enough of what needed to be released to feel that you're just a whole part of all of this. And then there's this gathering that's vast that comes just from that release. And to heed the wisdom, to listen to the wisdom that comes together when the four faculties are working. When they are operating, it's like we have more room, just like I had more room to make my choice about the cherry preserves and many other things. And we have more room because the creativity is flowing through us differently when we're more aligned with all of these previous faculties. And so they become available to us to then have this place to sit where we can discern that works, that really doesn't work, that leads to danger, that actually leads to the peace and calm and what's salvific about this practice. And that's wonderful to heed that again and again about the big things and the small things. Everywhere it's the same practice, no matter what it is. And they're always waiting for you and to guide you and keep you company. So I'd like to end with another discussion, another few stanzas of being a sage at peace. This is someone asking a question of the Buddha. Having what morality is one said to be at peace? Tell me this, O Gotama. You're asked about the Supreme Person. All of you. Not angry, not intimidated, not boastful, not beset with worry, a speaker of discretion, not pompous. She truly is a sage whose speech is restrained. With no attachment to the future, she does not sorrow over the past. A viewer of detachment among stimulations, she is not led into views. She is free to discern and find that just trusting, enjoying, loving, revering, and heeding is enough and better than attachment to a view. Thank you very much for your attention.